Welcome to the program, God and Country Radio, a program that looks at current political, social, economic, prophetic events in the light of biblical exposition. I'm your Bible teacher, Pastor Brad Winship. Today's program is about tariffs and free trade. Since President Trump has pledged to raise tariffs on imported steel 25% and on aluminum 10%, last week the president put out a series of tweets on this subject, which included this tweet. The United States has an $800 billion a year trade deficit because of our very stupid trade deals and policies. Our jobs and wealth are being given to other countries that have taken advantage of us for years. They laugh at what fools our leaders have been. No more. Signed, Donald J. Trump. And the reaction? Headlines of the Wall Street Journal. Trump's tariff vow rattles the market. And the stock market took a dive. Politicians and businessmen on the political right and the political left are up in arms over this because the economic philosophy of free trade is the conventional wisdom of our day. Critics of free trade are considered intellectual Neanderthals. One conservative Christian pundit, who has a nationwide following, put out the following article. The Trump recession begins this week. It's entirely avoidable. Donald Trump is set to announce tariffs on aluminum and other products as early as today. If he goes through with it, he will trigger a recession that undoes all the economic gains so far made during his presidency. It's not rocket science. It's economics 101, basic economics that the left and the right tend to agree on. Only the fringe on each side disagrees. And the president has been captured by fringe economists and his own outmoded thinking. So the question's this. Is the right policy free trade or protectionism and tariffs? Now, don't touch that radio dial. I know that more than half of those listening have just zoned out. I mean, what can be more boring than economic policy? You're probably thinking, let's talk about something interesting like evangelism or the culture war or prophecy. Well, I have to admit that economics is an acquired taste. It takes some experience, it takes some education to appreciate the huge significance of economic policy. The Bible does address economic policy. Nations have risen and fallen because of immoral economic policy. And I guarantee you that the citizens of Venezuela, who are eating dogs to survive, have found a new interest in economic theory. As their fearless leader, Nicolas Maduro, runs the economy into the ground with Marxist economic policy. Most people will never appreciate economics until it affects their life. There are billions of people in this world who can never get out of poverty, no matter how hard they work, because there's no economic infrastructure. The whole economic system is wrong and unjust. Proverbs chapter 13, verse 23, abundant food is in the fallow ground of the poor, but it's swept away by injustice. See, the world is filled with all sorts of natural resources and wealth, but bad economic policy on the part of politicians keep people poor. So, when your job is outsourced to some foreign country, because that other country either artificially keeps their exchange rates low or has communistic slave labor, then all of a sudden, economic policy matters. But beyond these personal concerns, as Christians, we should care about economic policy because the second great command is to love our neighbor as ourselves. And remember the Good Samaritan. He helped that poor, beat-up man get out of the ditch. He put him up in a hotel. And the ditch that many people have fallen into is unjust economic policy. And we ought to help individuals. But we also ought to be able to see the big picture and help out an entire nation by providing biblical economic counsel. Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Remember the poor wise man who saved the entire city through his wisdom. 9:18. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. And in just a few years, bad economic policy can destroy an entire nation. It can destroy an economy that took 2 centuries to build. And once you lose it, it's 10 times harder to get it back. So what about our president's plan to raise tariffs? Is this a terrible thing, as so many pundits are now claiming? Well, first, let's look at the arguments for free trade. No tariffs, no duties. These arguments on the surface are quite seductive. And the basic economic argument is this. If I buy an apple from you for 25 cents, have I lost 25 cents worth of wealth? No. I've gained an apple. So in this exchange, no wealth is lost. Therefore, no wealth is ever lost in free trade. If the United States buys from another country, we get the products, and the other country gets our currency. Now, what are they going to do with U.S. currency? Put it under a mattress? No, eventually they have to buy something from us. Otherwise, we were able to get a product in exchange for paper money. And the other country is only hurting itself if it doesn't buy our products. To quote one economist here, every dollar traveling overseas to buy imports in excess of our exports eventually comes back to the United States in the form of investment. And our trade deficit is matched by a capital account surplus. In other words, we buy goods and services from foreigners, and they buy an equal amount of our exports plus our financial assets, aka foreign investments in the United States. Sounds logical. Also, economists refer to what is called as comparative advantage. Some countries, because of natural resources and talent, can make products cheaper than our country. And it's to their advantage to not make everything, but to only make what they're good at, and then buy what they can from other countries that have their own advantages. This is all basic economics 101. David Ricardo, a British economist in the 19th century, he had this all worked out mathematically, that if each country does what it's good at and freely trades with other countries, everyone grows wealthier. The tide lifts all boats. And according to economic theory, it doesn't even matter if you're a lending nation or a borrowing nation. Economist Thomas Sowell says it this way. In general, international deficits and surpluses have had virtually no correlation with the performance of most nations' economies. Germany and France have had international trade surpluses while their unemployment rates were in double digits. Japan's post-war rise to economic prominence in the world included years when it ran deficits, as well as years when it ran surpluses. The United States was the biggest debtor nation in the world during its rise to industrial supremacy, became a creditor as a result of lending money to its European allies during the First World War, and has been a debtor and a creditor at various times since. Through it all, the American standard of living has remained the highest in the world, unaffected by whether it was a creditor or a debtor nation. We can spend the next 2 hours just looking into all the arguments favoring free trade. But just understand this. Free trade is all the rage at this time in human history. And according to the theories, it doesn't matter if a country has a trade deficit or even a national debt. But there's one problem with all this. You've probably guessed it. The Bible appears to teach that national debt and trade deficits are a negative for a country. Remember the blessings and the curses in the law of God? Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 6. For the Lord your God will bless you as he promised you, and you will lend to many nations, but you will not borrow. And you will rule over many nations, but they will not rule over you. So in the Mosaic Law, God describes the nation that is righteous and blessed of the Lord as having a trade surplus. And then Deuteronomy 28, 12. The Lord will open for you his good storehouse, the heavens to give rain to your land in its season and to bless all the works of your hand. And you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. The Lord will make you the head and not the tail, and you only will be above, and you will not be underneath. If you listen to the commandments of the Lord your God, which I charge you today to observe them carefully. Conversely, the curse of God was deficits, trade or fiscal. Deuteronomy 28:33. A people whom you do not know shall eat up the produce of your ground and all of your labors, and you will never be anything but oppressed and crushed continually. Deuteronomy 28:43. The alien who is among you shall rise above you higher and higher, but you will go down lower and lower. He shall lend to you, but you will not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you will be the tail. So apparently it does matter who lends and who borrows. It matters which way trade goes. Now, was Moses an economic simpleton, where he just didn't understand the nuances of Adam Smith's work, The Wealth of Nations? Was Moses just locked into an outmoded way of thinking? Well, it should give us some pause. When the economists of our day are saying that debt and trade deficits are nothing to worry about. Remember, economics is the only field in which two people can get a Nobel Prize for saying exactly the opposite things. And there are many other economist jokes. John Maynard Keynes, father of Keynesian economics. He was a man who believed in government intervention into the economy and the use of government debt to moderate business cycles. When he was asked about the long-term effect of his policies, his standard reply was, well, in the long term, we're all dead. Well, that kind of cavalier attitude toward the future concerns me. Given the ungodliness of our country and the postmodern relativism that has worked its way into every field, maybe this belief in the harmlessness of trade deficits or even national debt is a delusion that has fallen upon the wise men of our day for the judgment of the nation. Jeremiah 19:7, I will make void the counsel of Judah and Jerusalem in this place. I will cause them to fall by the sword. Jeremiah 8:9, the wise men are put to shame. They are dismayed and caught because they have rejected the word of the Lord, and what kind of wisdom do they have? No matter how much positive spin economists put on trade deficits, we still have this biblical principle, Proverbs 22:7, the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. So, why then do all of these economists today support unfettered free trade? Well, here's what I think is going on. I'm not an expert in these things, but I do have a graduate degree in business, and I came to these conclusions 30 years ago, sitting in macroeconomic classes at Rutgers Graduate School. And what I noticed was that the professors could show mathematically how free trade works for everyone's benefit, but formulas do not take into account sinful human nature. People and nations engage in trade for all sorts of other reasons than simply short-term economic gain. They often engage in predatory business practices, trading at a loss until they can put their competitors out of business and monopolize an industry. And that kind of behavior can't be quantified into mathematical formulas. I think the prime example is the subprime mortgage crisis in 2007, where the banks were making fraudulent loans and reselling the paper. Alan Greenspan, the economist, chairman of the Federal Reserve at that time, did not believe that the subprime mortgage crisis could ever happen. He testified before Congress saying, "Those of us who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity, myself included, are in the state of shock and disbelief." Why? Well, you see, according to economic theory, everyone working in their own self-interest will police the market so that the market will run efficiently and criminals and cheats will be thrown out. But that's not how the real world works. You can't quantify in formulas human greed and the desire for power. I really believe the reason for this blind adherence to free trade is at its root a disbelief in human sin. Economic theory today teaches that market forces, man's supply and demand, will produce fairness. But the Bible teaches that man's desires, even man's economic desires, are not always right, and they must be regulated by the law of God. Might does not make right. Economic decisions must first be made by biblical ethics and second by supply and demand. And so in Micah chapter 2, we read that just because someone has the economic power to do something doesn't make it right. And in Isaiah chapter 5, verse 8, it is possible for people to monopolize. And in James chapter 5, verse 4, the pay of the laborers can be withheld. Contracts between employees and employers and trade partners can be unjust even if they're mutually agreed upon. Deuteronomy 24 teaches that one can have the economic power to oppress the poor and the needy with low wages. Economists claim that that's not possible to do because the oppressed worker would simply find some more productive work to do. I believe Nixon's greatest error was not Watergate. It was opening up trade with communist China, where we used desperate people laboring under a communist system to make our stuff. That's not the level playing field of free trade. But economists say, well, it doesn't matter, because in the end, the markets will create an equilibrium and fix all that's wrong. But that's not what the Bible teaches. In reality, people can cheat when it comes to free trade. I mean, even with all of this talk about free trade, don't imagine that there's a level playing field here. The EU levels a 10% tariff on all U.S. car imports, and we only put a 2.5% tariff on their car imports. How do economists justify this? Well, they say it doesn't matter. They say that the Europeans are only hurting themselves with higher tariffs on their imports. Now, this is kind of deep, but the battle is between two ideologies. Laissez-faire economics, free trade where the markets police themselves, or an external authority of ethics imposed upon the markets, the law of nature and nature's God. Christians do not believe that whatever man does with his money will result in prosperity and justice. It's not right for everyone to do what is right in his own eyes. Judges 21:25. God's moral laws need to be imposed upon the activities of men, especially in this area of business and trade. So this is where I depart from some of my conservative friends. I am not a laissez-faire free trader because there are monopolies, there is slave labor, there are predatory practices, and there's a need for national sovereignty. And simple free trade formulas don't account for all this. A picture is worth a thousand words. So Let me refute this free trade philosophy with a story about how trade actually works. Imagine a farmer who has a large family, a large farm. We'll call him Farmer Number One. And this farmer has worked to build and protect his wealth by doing most of the work himself on his farm. Now, the advocates of free trade tell Farmer Number One that any smart farmer will never attempt to make at home what it will cost him more to make than to buy. So rather than making everything at home, he should buy products made by his neighbor. And in economic fairyland, Farmer Number One trades with Farmer Number Two, and they both prosper. But let me tell you how this works in the real world, where real moral human beings are involved. Farmer One has worked hard to build his farming business. Farmer Two next door works in his own self-interest, and he wants more power, he wants more wealth than his neighbor. In fact, he would like to take over Farm Number One and make Farmer Number One his slave. So, Farmer Number Two manufactures alcohol and trinkets and well-advertised designer clothing, hoping that by selling to Farmer One, he can gradually whittle away Farmer Number One's wealth. Now, the sons of Farmer Number One have begun to grow lazy. And rather than making clothing and trinkets in their own shop, they find it a whole lot easier to spend their father's hard-earned, accumulated money on products made by Farmer Number Two. In fact, the sons get so lazy that they decide to sell the tractor and to hire Farmer Number Two to plow their farm. Now, with the machinery sold and the skill of plowing lost, the sons of Farmer Number One can't easily reverse this arrangement. But they really don't need to anytime soon because their father has built up so much wealth in the bank because he was so conservative with his money. However, the sons of Farmer One keep buying services and products from Farmer Two until they've sent all of their dollars over to Farmer Two. They've done this in the form of huge trade deficits. Now, in the short term, it seems like Farmer Number One's sons have the life of luxury. But all of a sudden, there's a problem on Farm Number One. There's not enough money to go around. Now, the free trade economists come along and say, well, no problem. Farmer Number Two has to eventually do something with all of the dollars he has earned from Farmer Number One. He will eventually buy products from Farmer Number One and his sons. But in real life, Farmer Number Two is smart. He doesn't buy products from Farmer Number One. He buys up Farmer Number One's tractor, and he buys up Farmer Number One's land. He bankrupts Farmer Number One, buys up the farm, and rehires the farmer's sons as indentured servants. The economic reality is that one neighbor becomes rich by producing, and the other neighbor becomes poor by consuming. So let me conclude with this one thought. I've been talking about how intellectuals in this world have their theories and how the scriptures give us a deeper wisdom into the true nature of economics. I hope you see in all this that if the scriptures can provide for us true wisdom in regard to economics, how about turning to the scriptures and to the gospel message for the salvation of your soul? You've been listening to God and Country Radio. The radio website to listen to this program again or other past programs is godandcountryradio.org. Thank you for making God and Country a part of your discipleship in the Word. Let's close in prayer. Father in heaven, there are many ways that seem right unto a man, but the ends thereof are the ways of sorrow, pain, loss, death. May we humble our pride and accept your answers for this life and the life to come. In the name of Jesus Christ, we ask. Amen.